because I spent most of my life in a newsroom checking facts, making sure all the facts were right. When I'm writing fiction, I don't have to do that. I make stuff up. And it's like there's a freedom to that that is, it's very exhilarating, which is probably why I always did it, even when I was working in a newsroom.
Welcome to the Beyond the Newsroom podcast, where we talk with guests about, you guessed it, life after news. I'm one of your hosts, Lou Dubois.
And I'm Diana Alvear. And we're two former NBC News colleagues turned real life friends, now building careers in new industries. But we'll always be journalists at heart.
And storytellers. And on this podcast, you'll be hearing story after story from other journalists who've gone on to find professional success and happiness in new places.
And in this episode, we're talking to Dick Belsky.
Welcome to Beyond the Newsroom. Dick Belsky is an award-winning author of crime fiction and a journalist in New York City. His newest mystery, It's News to Me, was published last October by Ocean View. It's the fifth in a series featuring Claire Carlson, the news director for a New York City TV station. The first book, Yesterday's News, was named Best Mystery of 2018 at Deadly Inc. The second through fourth received many accolades. And Belsky has published over 20 novels in total, all set in the New York City media world, where he has had a long career as a top editor at the New York Post, New York Daily News, Star Magazine, NBC News, and others. He writes under the moniker Dana Perry and R.G. Belsky, and he's a contributing writer for the Big Thrill magazine. So, Dick, great to have you, and welcome to Beyond the Newsroom. I'm going to start here because I think it's something that a lot of journalists think they have in them. They think they have a book in them, but you've had over 20. So tell us a little bit about that transition from journalism to being an author.
First, glad to be here. Glad to see you again, Lou, who I worked with in two different locations at NBC. Obviously, I think you were in Philadelphia with Local and then with NBC News. And good to meet you, Diana. How do you write novels? You know, everybody always asks me that because pretty much everybody in a newsroom, as you know, you two know, they always are going to write a novel. You know, I mean, everybody's like, oh, I want to write a novel. I have an idea for a novel. What do you do? And, you know, I don't mean to be simplistic, but it's a simplistic answer. It's write. Just write the damn book. And that's what you got to do. I know so many people that have talked about writing novels and only a handful actually write the novel. And I'm happy to say that for better or worse, I wrote. And a lot of people say to me, they'll say we're in this topic here Beyond the Newsroom, and they'll say, oh, it's really cool. You worked all those years in journalism. And then when you left the newsroom, you started writing books. Isn't that nice? And that isn't true. I was writing books the whole time I was in journalism. My first novel was published, I think, in 1985. But I was writing books even before that. So that's really the key. It's just I like to write. I like to write fiction. It's completely different than what I did as a journalist. And that's the starting point, sitting down at the screen. And, it's like starting a story in a newsroom, only you have to write a whole book.
I'm one of those people that was like, I have a novel in me. And I wrote a book and we ended up publishing it ourselves. My friend illustrated it. And it just was such an accomplishment. Like there was no monetary benefit to it, by the way. This was just a passion project for us.
Yeah.
But, way back in 1985, like there was no internet. And I just think about all the things that enable us to do what we do today because of the internet. You wrote your first book back then. How did you go about getting it published? Because you still had your day job. And a day job in news is really demanding. So were you writing at night? Were you sending letters and manuscripts out? How did you do it?
All of those things, Diana. I'm a morning writer. I can't write at night. I always feel like I want to do my work before I do the newsroom work. So I would get up. There was a period where I was starting work at the New York Post at 6 a.m. in the morning. And this was during the period where I wrote that first novel. And I would get up at 4 a.m. and like write for an hour every morning. And then I would, get ready and get to work at 6. So, it sounds very disciplined, but again, I did it because I wanted to do it. I mean, nobody was forcing me to do that. And then, getting a book published is very, very difficult. It was completely different back then in the 1980s. because yeah, there was no internet. I mean, you had to go to the, you had to go to the library or whatever, or to a bookstore and get a book on list of publishers. And then you wrote letters. You remember that with a, you know, you actually wrote on a typewriter. And I got my acceptance in a letter. I always remember that. I mean, people now, I mean, you get emails like when I, at NBC, I got accepted for a book and I like stood up in the newsroom in the NBC newsroom and went, I just got my novel sold, you know, because I'd seen the email. But back in the 1980s, I went to my mailbox and I opened a letter and it was from a publisher and there were, we would like to publish your novel. And at first you know, you're like, wait, is this real? I mean, what is this? Is this a scam or whatever? But again, people say, oh yeah, so you wrote the novel and you had it published. Well, I had an agent. I got an agent first, which is always a good idea. This agent sent my book around to, you know, 20 plus publishers. None of them bought it. I, on my own, sent it out to a place, a mid-sized publishing house in Chicago called Academy Chicago, and they bought it. But it took at least a couple years to get it sold after the book was written. So it's not easy. And even now, it's always a struggle, a fight, because there's so much more competition now, you know, with self-publishing and more publish, you know, I mean, publishing has completely changed too, because it's, you know, so much of it is digital now. Yeah, it's a long struggle, but it's fun. You know, that's why I do it.
You talked a little bit about the criticality of writing just as a practice and kind of just doing that to get into this. I'm curious though, it's a very different type of writing, Dick, right? When you're talking about, you know, writing for news and writing crime fiction novels.
Yeah, sure.
What was it that made you say, like, I've got that muscle, and also it's something I enjoy? Because clearly if you're writing 20 books, it's got to be something you enjoy.
Yeah. Well, with me, there's always a moment. And with me, it came at some point in the 1970s. And I had wanted to write outside newsrooms, like write articles and maybe some short stories and things. I had read like a bunch of Ringlardner and some of the great, you know, some great people from the past, but I didn't really get too serious about it. And then I was in a bookstore and I picked up a copy of Raymond Chandler, The Big Sleep. And like a lot of mystery people, I was just kind of blown away by it, you know, and I was, wow, you know, this is really cool. I'd like to write this kind of book. So I sat down some point in the late 70s and thought, I'm going to write a mystery. And it didn't work. You know, I suddenly realized like it wasn't easy putting it in my character. My character was, you know, completely ripped off probably from Philip Marlowe. I mean, it was a, you know, a tough news guy wearing a hat and all, every cliche in the book. So, but that was the start and that inspired me. And then at some point when I had created a reporter character, because I decided I'd write about what I know, a friend of mine read the book and said, you know, this is a pretty good book, but it would be a lot more interesting if your character was a woman. And so I switched the character, made her a woman. Her name was Lucy Shannon, and she became a female reporter at this New York newspaper. And, you know, back in the 1980s, the role of a woman in journalism was a lot tougher than it is today. You know, very few women were allowed to cover, you know, crime stories or court cases. They were much more relegated to features and things like, you know, the food pages, society pages. So it made it more interesting to write. I mean, she had to overcome a lot of sexism and stuff in the workplace. And as it turned out, I've written 20 books, and I think 14 of them have a female protagonist. And the reason is I find women actually just very interesting to write about, even though I'm obviously not. There's just a lot more to do sometimes with the character than you can with the grizzled old newspaper veteran.
Are you scaring yourself into finishing your books? Are you like, okay,
well, I don't have any choice. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, what is your choice? I'm very good at the beginnings of writing beginnings of books. I have a lot of ideas for a beginning, and I work, you know, getting that I'm a great believer because, like, when I go to a bookstore or when I like click on something, which is more likely now on Kindle, and start to read it in one of the samples or whatever, I'm either bought in or not by the first couple graphs, you know, like, oh, I get this, I like this, or I'm bored or whatever. So I work real hard at getting a beginning that, you know, that grabs people. And then I'm pretty good at the ending, because, you know, like, at the ending is actually kind of where you bring everything together and you bring all these elements together. And that's kind of good. The middle is this vast wasteland of, like, where do I go with all this? You know, and I'm not the only, you know, I've talked to other prominent authors who have the same thing. And in the middle of it, you're like, well, you know, I've got to finish the book. In my case, I have a contract, but you really don't know where you're going. What I tend to do, and this has worked for me so far, is I just raise a lot of questions in the middle of the book that I don't even know what the answers are. Like I'll have somebody, a body show up, or I'll have somebody disappear, go missing or something. And then in the last half of the book, I'll go back and say, okay, now I've got to answer all these things, all my setups throughout the book. And generally I'm able to come up with an answer. And if I'm not, I can go back and take that part out. But basically I do a lot of questions, and then I try and come up with answers at the end of the book. And one of the criticisms you can sometimes get as a fiction author that I don't believe in a lot is, well, you have to be believable. You know, no matter what, it's got to be believable. Well, if it's too believable, you know, it's fiction. I mean, it's like when you watch, you know, Ozark or something on TV, or The Sopranos, you know, that's not believable. It's fiction. So I try not to get too hung up. You know, people will say to me, wow, you really capture what goes on in a newsroom every day. And my answer is, no, I don't. That's not what a real newsroom is like. I mean, a real newsroom, you know, Lou, you and I shared it, it can often be very boring. You sit there, you get some coffee, you look at the screen, you're like, what the hell am I doing today? But you can't write about that. You know, in my books, everybody is like running around and breaking big stories. And I always tell the one example I always give is that in all my career in journalism, which began when I was, you know, in my early 20s and lasted for decades, I never once heard of one reporter ever who solved a murder on their own. Not, you know, not with the police or anything, but solved a murder on their own. Never heard of one. In my books, my characters solve a murder every book. You know, I mean, Claire goes out and she solves a murder. So that's not necessarily believable, but, you know, to me, it's an interesting, and I think to other people, it's an interesting story.
I could listen to you talk about your process and the incompleteness of that middle for a long time. I can't have you on here. We're going to move to a little bit of the life, you know, and some of the skills that we talked about before we got on here that journalists are taking to these other careers. I can't have you on without asking about headlines, because it's kind of what's defined your career. I'd love to hear from you, you know, what makes a good headline writer, first off, and then B, you know, you have to tell the story, because I've heard it before, about your most famous headline.
Yeah.
Headless body, topless bar, for our listeners here.
Well, first off, you know, headlines, as you know, are different in different places. If you're writing headlines for the New York Times, obviously it's a very straight, you know, most of the time it's a very straight headline. I spent, you know, much of my career, 20 years of my career at the New York Post, a lot of it during Rupert Murdoch's first time around, like in the 80s, late 70s, early 80s, when it was at its wildest and most tabloid. And that's the one where we would have headlines like, beside Headless Body and Topless Bar, there were so many others. I mean, it was Gaddafi Goes Daffy and Granny Slain in Pink Pajamas and all that. And there weren't any alternatives to the tabloid papers, or very few. I mean, the only way people got news back, like in the early 80s, when Headless Body and Topless Bar was written, was through the newspapers or the local TV stations. Now, there were the three networks, but I think CNN had just started. There was no Fox News, no MSNBC. I mean, obviously, there was no internet or streaming or anything like that. So at the height of the New York Post in the I think it was, well, 1983 is when this headline took place. But during the 80s and the early 80s, the New York Post sold 1 million copies a day, almost 1 million. We had a thing on there that said 960 a day. But if you had a big story, like somebody died or something, you would go over a million. I mean, think about that. I mean, like newspapers now sell like maybe 60,000, big paper even.
That's crazy.
And you would write the headline. And again, I wasn't really a headline writer. I was in the newsroom, but I worked with, you know, obviously I worked with all the people that did, and we would all throw ideas out. But you would get off work and then you would walk to the city and there'd be newsstands everywhere with your headline. It was like really an exciting time. It will never exist again, but it was very cool. And at the Post, you had people who, this is what they did. I mean, there was a specialty. So one of the most famous headline writers, he wound up being featured in People magazine. He actually went on the David Letterman show, was a guy who was actually a friend of mine, Vincent Musetto. And he was the person who has been credited, even though there are many people who claim to have come up with it, for probably the most famous tabloid headline ever, which is Headless Body and Topless Bar. And so I spent all these years in journalism, and that's probably the thing I'm best known for. I mean, if you Google Dick Belsky, you'll see Dick Belsky, Headless Body, and I've written about it and I've talked about it. And, you know, I didn't write the headline. I was in the newsroom when it, and I played a role in it. And I always say it's kind of like the Woody Allen line, like, the most important thing in life sometimes is just showing up and being there, you know. So I showed up in the newsroom that day and I was there. And it was about 6 o'clock in the morning, and I had just gotten in, and Musetto, who was the managing editor, comes over to me and he said, "I've got this story. It's about a guy who robbed a bar in Queens and killed the bartender, or killed the owner or something, and cut off his head. And I've got a great headline: Headless Body and Topless Bar." But then he said, we don't know if it's a topless bar. We think it might be, but we're not sure. And obviously you can't write the headline and know it's a topless bar. Now, again, in the year 2023, the idea of finding out whether something is a topless bar or not is a no-brainer. I mean, you go online, you Google it, you do whatever, you know. But in 1983, you couldn't do any of that stuff. So you had to get on the phone. And we called the police. We called people in the neighborhood, and everybody was like, "Well, we don't know if it's topless bar." Nobody knew. So I sent a reporter out there, and they looked, and there was no sign or anything. It was just a bar. Nobody knew anything. This went on for most of the morning. And then at some point, the reporter, a woman named Marilyn Matlick, and God bless her that she did this, she said, "I'm going to try and look in the place." And she went around the back. She got on a trash can. She looked through this dirty window, and there was a sign that said "Topless Dancing Tonight." And we were like, "Okay, we got it. We got the headline." And the footnote to all this is we didn't run the headline. It was for the afternoon edition, because the editor at the time decided it was too sensationalistic and didn't want. He said, "No, I don't want to do it." But the next morning they changed their mind and they ran it. So, you know, I guess my role in that was, I always say, I was the fact checker. You know, I was the guy that was able to come up with the facts on the headline. And it became so famous that when the guy who wrote it died a few years ago, Vincent Musetto, he wound up on page one of the New York Times. And the opening line was, the man who wrote Headless Body and Topless Bar, you know, died. So I think that and Ford to City Drop Dead are the two most famous tabloid headlines ever. And I was able to be a part of one. So
I have to tell you, we studied this in J school. Like when I was in journalism school, like that headless body and a topless bar was brought up as the single greatest headline of all time. Like it, you know, in just mere words, you captured the entire gist of the story. And so it's like, it's vivid in my brain.
It also made, when you're in daily journalism, there's a lot of crime that takes place. And most of it doesn't make the paper, you know, and there's always been the argument like, well, so you have the rich white girl who gets written about, but then 10 other women get killed. So there's always this issue of what you write about. And in this case, it was basically like what you would call, I guess, in those days, like a cheap crime. You know, it was like a bar, downtrodden bar, and somebody robbed him and killed a guy. And without that headline, it probably would have been a Metro brief. You know, it would have been like man shot, you know, whatever. That headline made it one of the most famous. So that just shows you the power of a headline. And the New York Post, because of the nature of what it was, I mean, really perfected that idea of the headline, and it would sell the entire paper.
We talked about something right before we started recording here that I'd love for you to dig into. Like when you got into journalism, there was never a thought of life beyond news, right? This was the career you got into. Yeah. That is not the way the world works today. I'd love for you to expand upon that thought a little bit.
Yeah, and that was something I had some trouble dealing with, because when I was in Vietnam, I got drafted, by the way. So everybody always goes like, oh, that's great. You know, no, I got drafted, but I wound up in Vietnam. And when I got out of Vietnam, I got a job as a reporter at the New York Post, which I thought was great. And everybody at the New York Post had been there like for their entire lives, you know, at that point, you know, and there were a lot of people that they would start there as a copy boy and they would retire there 40, 50 years later. And I always saw myself doing that. I loved the Post. I loved what I did. I never like went around looking for other jobs or anything like that. And I think most people felt that way. And I was there 20 years, and then there was some regime changes. Murdoch had to sell the paper and wound up being taken over by Peter Calico, who was a big businessman. And then there were a lot of changes made. And I actually, they made it very easy for me to leave, and I got fired, you know, and once you're fired, you know, there's no decision. They're like, no, don't come here anymore. So after 20 years, I suddenly was out. And then I had a sort of a, you know, still a pretty steady career, but I spent 10 years at Star Magazine, and we could talk for hours about that too, because that was celebrity journalism in the days when, you know, there was no TMZ or anything. So everybody got their celebrity news from the supermarket tabloids. We sold 3.5 million copies a week. You know, everybody read everything in the supermarkets. Then I spent 5 years at the New York Daily News, which is a much more, I'm going to say conservative, but a much more kind of like sedate than the Post. I mean, much more, you know, respected, you know, in many ways. So I did 5 years there, which I loved. And then, of course, then I went to NBC, which was a whole other thing, which was like, and I went there because of, only because of one of your previous guests, Greg Gittrich, got a big job there. And I'd worked with him at the Daily News. And he said, why don't you? I was like, I don't know anything about TV news or digital news. But I went and, you know, spent 6 years there, and it was great. But yeah, I mean, now I talk to people and they've had maybe, you know, 5 jobs in 3 years or something. And there's nothing wrong in that. I mean, it's just that's the way it works. There's also so many more job opportunities now. I mean, you have every website and all sorts of stuff. When I was at the Post, I mean, you either worked at the Post or you worked at the Daily News, maybe the New York Times, although they didn't like to hire directly from the tabloids, or go to one of the, you know, the half dozen TV stations in town. And those were your alternatives. So, I have to tell you, there's a part of me that misses that, because it really was a nice sort of situation. And your whole world revolved around the newsroom that you were actually in. And, you know, Lou, you and I shared a newsroom at NBC, and which Greg played a big part in. And that kind of an atmosphere is what, you know, we had at a lot of these places. And if you've never worked in a newsroom, I feel sorry for you, because it's such a, you know, in its day, and I'm not sure that it's quite the same now, in its day, going into a newsroom was just such a wild, it was rough and ready and wild and fun. And, but, you know, like those, those days of the print paper are obviously long gone, but I was really fortunate to have been able to play a big part in it.
So from your seat, you know, you got started in the 70s and then you watched the industry change over the last few decades. You know, what to you remains the same about journalism? Like, what would you say to people who are working in journalism today? Like, what's the through line? No matter how many changes you see, like, what's good journalism to you?
It's the good story. You know, it's all about the stories, whether, you know, I started out at the Post, and when I started at the Post in the 1970s, we actually wrote our stories on a device called the typewriter, which shows you how long ago it was. And like one of the first big stories I covered was like Son of Sam. You know, I mean, this shows you how long ago that was. It wasn't until I got to NBC. I didn't even know what Twitter was until I got to NBC. And it was like people are talking, what's Twitter? What's that all about? But throughout all of that, I think it's still the good story. I mean, and I don't mean to say, when I talk about how great the old days were, that isn't to say that I didn't have a lot of fun. I mean, I had a terrific amount of fun in my last job at NBC for those 6 years, working with digital, because it gives you so many more opportunities to do things, you know, and some of them are very selfish ones. But, you know, I always say, like I think it was the Boston Marathon bombing, and the facts are coming in like, you know, every second, like, you know, three people are dead or four, you know, 12 people injured and all this stuff is happening. So when a breaking story is happening, when you're on a newspaper, you put it in the paper and then the paper goes out and it's gone and it's out there. And if it's wrong, you're like, oh God, I got to fix that in the next edition or I got to fix that the next day. The great thing about working on like stories on a website is, you know, like if you get the number wrong in the headline or whatever, you can change it in 2 seconds. You switch it and suddenly you're back to what it is. There are so many advantages to like journalism today. So I don't mean to say it isn't fun because it's great fun, but it's still all about the story. You know, I mean, it's still all about what, you know, what people want to read and it's this balance between what people should read and what people want to read. I think the biggest concern that I've seen, and again, I'm not in the journalism world for the past, whatever, 6-7 years, the biggest concern I have when I read journalism now is when we were at newspapers, there was so much fact checking. In other words, it was very hard to get something in the paper without it going through a lot of people and a copy disk. With all the websites now, you know, people in Twitter and everything, people throw stuff up, a lot of which is inaccurate. And that's something I'm not familiar with. And certainly when we were at NBC, and you both know this because you work there, we had really, you know, strong standards of what we had to do to get, like if somebody died, we wouldn't run that story until we got it confirmed by their spokesman. Even if, you know, somebody else was running it, we didn't just run with stuff. But I mean, there's so much stuff now, you can't really police any of it. And so I think that's a big difference.
I feel like the beginning of the end, and I know Lou has a question for you, but the beginning of the end happened when Michael Jackson died and TMZ was the first. I remember I was working and I was at ABC and they were freaking out because TMZ was reported Michael Jackson had died and we could not confirm it. And therefore we could not run with it. And I feel like that has changed.
No, we did that both at the local Lou, you know, with stories and then with the, and then at NBC. And of course, you know, we had a whole, as you know, we had a whole department of standards at NBC that we had to get stuff passed if we wanted to run it. But the interesting footnote on the Michael Jackson thing, because I remember that I was at NBC local then, and he died the same day that Farrah Fawcett died. And I always remember that because we were like waiting for Farrah Fawcett because we knew she was very sick with cancer. And, you know, that was going to be this big story. Farrah Fawcett is dead. And instead, of course, Michael Jackson died, which kind of changed everything because it was so sudden and so unexpected. But deaths. deaths were always the biggest, one of the biggest problems we had wherever I went, because you never wanted to say someone was dead, and you always would prefer to be late than to be the guy who said somebody was dead and then they were alive.
You don't want to kill somebody before they're dead. That was always the line.
That's a good journalism rule, I always felt. You know, I kind of operate.
Oh, boy.
Now, in my books, I can do whatever I want.
See? Dick, this has been awesome. I have one last question for you as we kind of wrap up here. So whether you're thinking about getting into writing crime fiction or novels in general, or thinking about other, you know, kind of career paths, I'd be curious what advice you have for journalists today, younger, otherwise, as to like they think about their second career and what you've learned through that process.
Wow. everybody I know, including you, you know, have had like a lot of interesting second careers. For me, it's just doing what I want to do. I've never had a job where I didn't like what I was doing. So I happen to like writing. And again, I wrote all those years, even, you know, so now being able to get every day, and I do it like a job. So I think you just have to, follow your instincts and what you do. Because, you know, working every day at a job that you're not, you don't like, or with people you don't like is very hard. And everybody thinks being a writer is lonely, but it's not really, because, you know, first off, I work in a lot of groups. I don't sit in my house and write. I belong to the writer's room in New York City. I go to coffee shops and write. I write with people around me, but I also spend a lot of time dealing with editors and agents and things like that.
I would love to know what it feels like when you sell the book and when you actually hold the book and you know that all of this exists because you started off with an idea. Yeah. Can you just tell us a little bit about what that feels like?
Well, it's pretty unbelievable. It's a great feeling. You know, I guess it's the same as having a big scoop or something on page one. I just posted something on Facebook, actually, which is that I was going through cleaning out a closet and I found my first piece of public fiction. And that was in 1982. I had a short story that was published by the Alfred Hitchcock Mystery Magazine, which is still around. And I wrote about how I remembered it. It might have been my biggest thrill ever, even more than the books, because it was the first time. I mean, I got a letter and they said, we would like to buy this. And it was the first time that something I wrote, that somebody actually wanted to buy it. And that's like a wonderful feeling. And certainly, you know, the first books obviously are a big deal. But even like, so I have 20 books down. I have 4 more coming out soon. It's still a big deal. Yeah, you see it and you go like, wow, you know, I remember sitting this with an idea. Now it's an actual book. But before we go, I just want to jump in, and, you know, you'll probably edit it out, but I just want to give a plug to what I got going. So I have.
Yeah, please go for it.
Absolutely.
It's News to Me is the most recent Claire Carlson. Otherwise, my publishers will yell at me. It's News to Me is the most recent Claire Carlson book. It's out in hardcover, Kindle, and Audible, like most books are these days. And there'll be a 6th Claire Carlson coming out in early 2024. But as you mentioned, I also write a series of thrillers under the name of Dana Perry. There's 4 of these that are out, and I'm in the process of writing 3 more for 2024. So right now, the one book that's out is the It's News to Me, but there's a lot more in the pipeline. And my final comment would be, like, if you liked It's News to Me or you wanted to start at the beginning of this series, most of those books, the last time I looked, at least for this month, are like on some kind of Kindle deal where you can get them on Kindle for like $1.99. So, you know, if you want to check me out for $1.99, it's probably worth the price to do.
I'm going to echo what Lou said. And I could listen to you all day. I probably have like 25 more questions that I could ask you, but I just want to say, thank you so much for talking to us about this, because it's so true. You're like, I have an idea for a book, or I want to write. That's like, you're right. Just do it. Literally just write.
What do you got to lose? You know, you write the book and you've never written another book. And if it doesn't work, you haven't lost anything. Nobody is going to say anything. So write it. That's what I say. Just write.
Dick, so great to see you. Thank you for the time. And I look forward to Claire Carlson's sixth book in about a year. But thank you again, and really appreciate having you on here.
Thank you, both of you.
Thanks, Dick.